Kathy Gowdy, alternate defense counsel appearing for our defendant, Mark Sandoval. I wish to begin with my argument then with the jury instructions. The jury instructions issue has two components. One, that the judge denied the crime of passion instruction requested by the defendant, although there was certainly evidence in the record to support it. And two, that the trial court denied the defendant's objection to giving a complicity instruction, despite the fact that even the district attorney admitted that Mr. Sandoval was being charged as a principal, not as a complicitor. The overall effect of this was to incorrectly instruct the jury as to the status of the law in their deliberations. Complicity is sort of a stepchild of accessory while not being a charge in and of itself. It, however, puts an aura over all of the testimony that comes in that even though you don't think that the elements were proven beyond a reasonable doubt, perhaps because he was with these people and he may have aided and abetted, therefore he is guilty of the crime charged without having to prove accessory. It should be used extremely lightly. In this case, it was not an appropriate instruction. When Mr. Sandoval was charged as the principal, and that was the whole focus, it is a confusion to the jury to state then he was assisting the principal. It infers he's assisting himself. It was incorrect, and it was an error.
Ms. Gowdy, can I ask you to clarify for me? Is your argument that the instruction was wrong because the prosecution's theory was he was a principal? Is it that there was no evidence to support complicity, or is it both?
Both.
Okay. Then I guess I have a couple of questions then following up. Isn't there case law that says that complicity is a theory, not a claim, and that the prosecution can proceed on both alternatively without electing?
There is.
Okay, so why don't we have that case here?
Because the district attorney in this case proceeded on the principal. He did not proceed on the complicity theory. His argument did not go to the fact he was there, ergo he must have been part of this gang that was throwing rocks.
Didn't the prosecution submit the instruction on the issue on complicity?
They did.
That would suggest that they were interested in both.
Or it could suggest that they wanted every instruction that could make their case look stronger.
Okay. But you're really focusing on the closing argument that said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, you don't even have to get to the issue of complicity because we're going on a principle theory here. Is that your focus?
That is correct, because the closing argument is where they discuss the instructions the jury has just received.
All right. But if the, and this will bleed into the second issue, assume with me for a moment that there were facts to support a complicity finding. Why isn't it appropriate to instruct, even if they were proceeding on the theory that this was a principle, the same as if in a case where you have a lesser included offense?
Because the instructions must correctly instruct the jury in what those facts are. And if the facts are that this person is charged as a principal, as one of the principals, then you're giving them a backdoor out to say, well, he's not quite a principal, but boy, is he a dirty, lousy little scumbucket, and we want to convict him. And it gives you that without there being a charge of that. So it is a very strong instruction that is very lightly interpreted in the case law, and it should not have been given in this case simply because of the inflammatory nature of the events and the charges.
All right, and kind of going on to this, and I understand your argument. Thank you for that. The second piece on the facts, I guess I'll posit to you what I understand the evidence to be and disagree. Tell me why this is wrong. There were at least some witnesses who said the defendant was one of the people throwing rocks. The defendant was there, several people identified, and I know there was some conflicting testimony about it. And then there was evidence that the defendant ran away with a group of people, that they're all in the same gang. Why isn't that enough to get, you know, a scintilla at least, to get to support a complicity instruction?
I think in this particular case, because of the gang innuendo that ran through that trial, it was not fully addressed, it was not fully kept out. There was a mere presence of him being there testimony. Not necessarily that he was seen with a rock.
Well, there was at least one witness that said, I saw him throw a rock.
I don't believe that was an eyewitness, but I could be incorrect. It's been a while since I read the record.
Okay. All right, but so if, let's take then as a hypothetical, we've both checked.
Okay.
If there was a witness that said, I saw this defendant throw a rock, is that enough then? You're saying just that he's standing there is not enough. But if there's a witness that says, or evidence that says this defendant threw a rock, and again, separating aside the first issue we talked about, is that enough to support a complicity instruction?
I think it would lead into the scintilla. I would still state that the district attorney did not rely on anything with complicitor in their argument, gave the jury no help, no argument, no instruction to clarify why it was there. So the instruction, when you read it in light of the district attorney's argument, incorrectly misled the jury. I guess that's a double negative. I'm sorry.
I understood it. Thank you.
Okay. And then when it ties in again with the crime of passion, and perhaps crime of passion is a confuser in this case because crime of passion infers some involvement in the matter. I did this, but I did this because they did acts that were provoking to me. And in this case, there was confused testimony about who was challenging who, people getting out of cars, then being chased through the streets in cars up and down alleys after the children had been left back at the party. Crime of passion might have been appropriate. It is the defendant's to elect to choose because of the place you're putting yourself out on the diving board that it infers that there's some involvement.
But was there any evidence of a provoking act by the victim?
The victim's testimony was that he then got out of the car and challenged them back. I would say that some of the more provoking, because there was not just the one incident with the rock throwing, then there was the later incident at the trailer house where the victim drove by, and then there was allegations of guns, but nobody was sure that the defendant was there or not, and it all got kind of muddled. And so I would say that overall the evidence as a whole did show that there was some retaliation back by the victim for the acts that had happened.
What about the time of the incident itself? I mean, let's assume for purposes of argument that he threw a rock.
Okay.
What happened there that would have given rise to the instruction? Outrageous conduct.
Well, there were rocks thrown before he got out of the car and rocks thrown after. It was never clarified which was the rock. It was never clarified which was the
end. There's no indication that the victim threw any rocks.
No, the victim came out and waved his hand and challenged and then said, stop it. It was mostly verbal, but it was strong words.
Well, he said, stop it, I have kids in the car.
Right, but I don't think it was quite that polite.
Yeah, fair enough. And for recording, we'll be polite. And then, as I understand it, the other men kind of at least gather around him and sort of threatening, at which point he said, you know, in not maybe so nice words, you want to fight, you know, you want to bring it. I guess those are the facts as I understand the evidence, even in the light most favorable to your client. I'm not quite sure what the provoking act, if that's the facts, where the provoking act is.
I read it more in the facts that were presented to the jury of the acts, then later in him chasing them, there being gunfire involved.
But that's after
it
the
is.
Rock throwing.
It is, but it was also put into evidence, so it was before the jury, and that was one of the problems with this case, is the events were kind of muddled. And I think what I'm saying and what I wanted to clarify from my brief that didn't come forward, that I think this was an either-or situation for due process. If you gave the complicitor the instruction, then he should have given the heat of passion because there's involvement with the group and there's some statement that he's involved. But if you're not going to let him have heat of passion as a possible reduction at the felony level, then you shouldn't give complicitor and bring him with the group as well, because I believe the similar evidence supports both arguments. And so I would think both needed to be in there together or neither. And that goes...
You see them linked.
In this particular case, I do. Because the complicitor there is, if he wasn't the principal, if he was just there with the group, it ties in with the crime of passion. Was he just standing with the group and he got yelled at and didn't think it was right through the rock? We don't know, but it was for the jury to decide. But if the complicitor instruction was not given, then he shouldn't have had heat of passion because they're taking the position, no, he wasn't involved at all. Heat of passion only comes in if the jury chooses to believe he was involved to some degree, but there was some provoking event. So it goes to, was he involved or not? Was he a bystander with the group, or was he there at all? Or was he involved to some degree but had some mitigator that would reduce the level of the felony the jury could find? And that's what they took away from the jury. We're still working it through on all the evidence, and I think it's a fact question. The jury should have decided that saw the facts. And the instructions needed to be given either together or not. And it goes overall then to the cumulative error in this particular trial. And the cumulative error includes all of the issues that I laid out specifically. The admissibility of the child's testimony to the police officer without the child being brought to testify, and no showing of inadmissibility. I went back and checked the record in light of some of the things in the brief, and it was clear in the record that the child was brought home after the event. There's a whole group of relatives there that surround the child, talk to the child. So there's intervening factors to anything said. The officer arrived sometime later. I believe the record said somewhere 20 minutes or 30 minutes, so we don't know how much time it was before. And then the officer interviews the 10-year-old with all of the relatives who are understandably upset by the situation, chiming in and being rather hysterical. It is not an excited utterance unless it's an excited utterance of a mass mindset, but it was not the child's excited utterance of the time. It was not admissible in and of its own strength, and it violated his rights to confront the accuser against him.
Ms. Gatti, let me ask you, and I'd say I'm sympathetic to your argument that this is not an excited utterance. I don't know if it's right, but at least it rings some bells with me. But why isn't it harmless? It seems to me whatever the child said to the police officer came in through a bunch of other witnesses. These guys threw rocks. We know that from other witnesses. Every single thing she said was cumulative. So why is it not harmless?
Then why was it offered if it was cumulative? It was offered for the very reason that we are all talking about it here with some degree of shock, that a child is in a car, the child is discussing the effect of having a rear view mirror window broken over its head with a rock and the shock of seeing their daddy run off. It was offered as emotional bolstering. And without the child there to question it, it could not be clarified. We also don't know which of the statements were made by the child and which were made by the relatives or the relatives speaking to the child before the officer. So there's credibility issues in what the officer testified to as the statement.
Well, yeah, and the officer said it's what the child told me.
It is, but he also testified there were other people talking there. We also do not know what was said to the child before the officer in a testimonial inquiry spoke to them. So there is not an indicia of reliability in the statement. Because of there was intervening factors, and we don't know. If the child had been there, perhaps it still would have been a little unclear, but it would have been the child's statement under oath as to what the child saw.
But what did the child offer that other witnesses didn't?
Emotionalism. I mean, an emotional tie that breaches in and that tied in then with the prosecutorial comment about what happens to these people after they testify, the fear. It added a fear-mongering to it with the prosecutor tied in with, why didn't that child come here? Perhaps they were afraid.
Was there any 403 objection made with respect to the child, this hearsay testimony?
No, there was hearsay objections, but there was not a 403.
And you allude, not, you probably want to save a little bit of time, but could you just clarify for me quickly, I'm not 100% sure what the prosecutorial misconduct is that you're relying on. Is it that the prosecutor made statements that were not supported by the evidence? Is that the issue?
It made that were not supported by the evidence, but that also went to a deep emotional tenor in this jury watching it. In the pretrial proceedings, there was a great deal of stuff about the gang and this and the Northsiders, Southsiders, and it was in the affidavit warrantless arrest, that was not allowed for the most part in the trial. So when you read the record, it's just what the jury saw there. They didn't see that evidence, except for a few statements isolated here and there. But the prosecutor got up and basically made one of those "you must take the stance as a community" arguments. It came perilously close to putting yourself in the shoes of the community to say, what are these people going to feel when they walk out? Or look what happens when people testify. It was improper. It ties in then with the whole cumulative argument, and I'll just finish now and not reserve any time, thank you. The whole cumulative, that the whole trial itself was tainted. They had what they thought was a gang member. This gang member was going to go down and be convicted, and all of the flaws in it together, all objected to, resulted in this not being a fair trial for this gentleman. Are there any other questions?
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you very much.
May it please the court, my name is Catherine Idala, registration number 39218, and I represent the people in this matter. Before I begin, I wanted to apologize to this court and counsel for an error in my brief with respect to the confrontation issue. As I was preparing for argument, I realized I relied on the King case from 2005, and I don't believe it's the most current authority on confrontation, and I do believe that the daughter's statements to the officer under more current authority would be considered testimonial because there wasn't an ongoing emergency at the time. But I do stand by the argument in my brief that the admission of the daughter's statements don't amount to plain error under the facts of this case, because there's no reasonable possibility that they contributed to the defendant's convictions, and really three reasons for that. Number one, I think that all of her statements concerned undisputed facts. I think defense counsel told the jury in both opening statement and closing argument that the basic events of this crime were undisputed, and I don't think I've heard anything different from defense counsel specifically on that today. And I think the daughter's statements were wholly cumulative to the victim's testimony of the incident. And they were also, and I think this is important, completely unrelated to the defendant's theory of the case. And that was really, to me, centered more on identification, that the victim couldn't identify the person who threw the rocks. But I'll turn next to the jury instructions, unless this court has any questions on that first issue. With respect to provocation or heat of passion, there wasn't any credible evidence of provocation in this case, and for that reason, the trial court didn't err in denying the defendant's request for that instruction. I don't see any evidence of a serious and highly provoking act by the victim. The defendant and the persons with him were the ones who set this crime in motion. It was undisputed that the victim was driving along with his children in the car when rocks started hitting the car. And I think he quite understandably stopped the car and got out and said, what's going on? Do you see I have my children here? And then I think he said in some colorful language, if you want to jump me, do it. Essentially, you can see that I'm completely outnumbered. If you're going to assault me, go ahead and get it over with. And I just don't think there's any credible evidence of a serious and highly provoking act.
Ms. Idala, how would you respond to Ms. Gowdy's argument about all the stuff that happened after the initial incident, that the victim clearly chased these guys down? And
certainly, there was a bit of a circus afterwards. My understanding of the record and the way this crime was prosecuted, that the basis for the charges, and I also understood this from reading the defendant's brief, that the assault, we're talking about that first initial incident. So, to be honest, I didn't think that the defendant was arguing that those events afterwards were part of the heat of passion. I don't believe it was argued that way in the trial court. And I think secondly, just turning to no serious and highly provoking act, but I don't think there was any evidence that this would have caused an irresistible passion in a reasonable person. And I understand from the brief that the defendant has been asking this court to consider this evidence of gang animosity, and I don't think that has any bearing on a reasonable person as that test is under provocation. And turning to the complicity instruction, I think the law is pretty clear that the prosecution can argue alternative theories of liability to the jury. So I don't see any problem, or perhaps the link that defense counsel is making between provocation and complicity. I think that there was certainly evidence to support giving a complicity instruction. I think the defendants...
Other than the fact that there were a group of people and the defendant was a member of the group, what is the evidence of complicity?
I think it's... I understand what you're saying is, how is this more than mere presence? And I think when you look at the circumstances of the way this assault occurs, you have four or five men who are all dressed in red, who, for no reason that I can see, start throwing rocks at the defendant's car. And then when he gets out, I think the sort of the strength in numbers and sort of intimidation factor that was going on there is kind of a complicity. And then I think when you...
Who's the principal?
It's a little bit unclear, but again, the jury didn't have to agree on this. I think there was certainly some testimony. I think this, and this came from the officer who was testifying to the victim's statements from the identification, that the defendant was the one who threw the rock. But then I think there was also some evidence from, I think his name was Troy Torres, who was the defendant's witness, that the defendant was there and not throwing the rocks. But I think clearly these men were all acting in concert in committing this crime.
I'm trying to picture how you can be complicit in throwing rocks if you, in fact, are not the one who threw them. What conduct? You talked about crowding around and the like, but is there anything else? Or is that It sounds pretty close to mere presence.
Okay. I think it's distinguishable from mere presence when you look at all of their actions together. And I think, you know, they were traveling as a group. They're all dressed the same. They all ran away together afterwards. And, you know, their behaviors seem largely indistinguishable to me. So I don't.
Well, that sounds like a conspiracy to me, not so much like a complicity.
I didn't intend it to sound like conspiracy.
It sounds like your best argument in the conspiracy statute is encouraging, you know, somebody else in committing the offense, you know, even if the defendant didn't throw it, you know, hey, you know, here's a rock, hands somebody else a rock or something like that, I guess, or even encourages them, throw another one. I guess you would say that would be enough?
I mean, I think so.
Okay. Now, there was this issue about the victim identifying the defendant prior to trial, but then didn't remember having done that.
Correct.
Did the photo evidence identification come in at trial?
You'll have to check on this to be sure. I believe it did.
Okay.
And I believe the victim's testimony at trial was that he didn't remember identifying the defendant at the photo lineup, but the police officer who did the photo lineup, I believe he testified that the victim identified the defendant in the lineup. But I think there's also, you know, I think there was other evidence of identification, just briefly point that out to the extent it was suggested otherwise, from the victim, the victim's brother-in-law, the officer who did the photo array, and also the defendant's own witness, all identified the defendant. And I think also, you know, when you think about requesting a heat of passion instruction is, you know, essentially, I think there were, that the defendant was certainly not, with respect to requesting that argument, denying that he was there. So I think identification was the issue that the defendant was relying on, but I think there was certainly ample evidence of identification. Does the court have any questions as far as prosecutorial misconduct or speedy trial? I think those are the only issues I haven't touched upon.
I want to go back, Ms. Idell, just a minute, since I asked a loaded question to Ms. Gowdy. I'll let you respond to this excited utterance issue. If we have to get there, and I'll confess to you, I'm a little concerned about saying that this was an excited utterance. Why do you think the child's statement to the officers in this context was an excited utterance?
Well, I think it was an excited utterance. I think there's some conflict as far as when the officers arrived afterwards. I believe I cited in my brief there was some testimony that it was something like 10 minutes after. I think the defendant has said 30 minutes. But I think no question that this was a startling event. I think probably the issue you're having a harder time with is whether the girl was still under the stress of that event. And I mean, I think that there's certainly enough evidence to make that finding. But again, I think if this court disagrees with me on that, I don't see how this can't be harmless under the facts of this case for the reasons that I discussed earlier, in that the testimony was over undisputed facts, cumulative to the victim's testimony, and then unrelated to the defendant's theory of the case.
Wasn't the child responding to questions from the officer? I mean, I usually view an excited utterance as something that's blurted out, that based upon the shock and the awe of the event.
Certainly.
Wasn't she just answering questions the officer asked?
I think in large part she was. But again, my recollection isn't crystal clear, so I think you have the record now.
Suggesting she wasn't under stress, but there's a difference between being under stress and an excited utterance.
Certainly, I understand what you're saying, and I think that is problematic in terms of the omission of the excited utterance. But again, I think that it was harmless. And if the court has no further questions, the people would ask that the judgment of conviction be affirmed.
Thank both counsel for your briefs and arguments. The matter will be deemed submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.